February 4th, 1978.
Helene, when were you born? And where?
You may have to give you the exact date when I was born.
No, just approximately.
Just approximately. Okay, I was born in 1922. And a small town in the southern eastern south of Poland, and Galicia, or Galicia, as it's called in English. And so I am a Galiciana, which I don't always admit to. The part of the country from which I come had changed hands each time something was happening politically in Poland, and so it was Austrian before World War II. It returned to Poland between the wars. It was occupied by the Russians for 2 years. Then by the Germans for, let's see, from 41 till 44, and it is now under the Russian occupation again. I say under the Russian occupation because I was a Polish citizen, and as such, I was a Polish patriot, I might say. And so if it is not Polish, then I call it under the Russian occupation.
What was life like for you as a child?
Fantastic. Life was beautiful. Now you got me. See, I was afraid of that.
I can do this all the time.
To answer your question, life was, my life was a very happy life. The memories from home are the things that have sustained me and still do. Someone once asked me, what did your parents do that has given you so much security that you've come out as you have? I don't know whether I've come out any differently than other survivors. I do know that I hope I have not come out embittered toward the world. I do not generalize. And I do ascribe this absolutely to my home life and my upbringing. I had a good fortune to have been born the third and an only daughter. Having had two older brothers, I was the apple in my father's eye. But if I'll start talking about this, I'll never get to anything else.
No,
so
ahead.
Maybe I better be
no,
brief
we'd
on
like to
that.
Hear that.
I admired my father, loved him dearly, and have loved him more with passing time. It's strange, I was only mentioning it last week to someone. That I still consult with my father. When facing a crisis, I think, how would father act or what would he advise? And he happened to have been the advisor to many people in town. I remember the home was always full of people, and in the evening, young and old, would come and the various problems, issues were discussed. I recall this specifically during the last few weeks during the meeting between Sadat and Begin, that during all my growing up years, the standard topic discussed in my home, as I suppose in many other Jewish homes, was if and when there is a Jewish state, and at that time we didn't know what that Jewish state would be called, and it seemed as miraculous a thing to happen as it had been those 2,000 years prior to its creation. But if and when a Jewish state arises, first of all, will it accommodate all the Jews? Little did we know that one-third of our people would not live to enter the Jewish homeland. And what about the Arabs and so forth and so on? And I was talking to a lot of people, and I was recalling that we settled those problems long before it happened. We knew exactly what it was going to be, and at no time did anyone ever say, well, we'll drive the Arabs into the sea. It was always the contention, yes, we will manage to live together peacefully, and well, it was just such a utopian, beautiful thought. So this was my, I would say, ideological background.
So your parents were both Zionists?
Everybody was a Zionist except for those who were either totally assimilated from Judaism, out of Judaism, or who were communists. But I would say universalist communists, because we have communists now in Israel as well. So even among the communists, there were those who believed in a communist Jewish state, and there were those who believed, no, that the Jewish state, the creation of a Jewish state, negates the communist philosophy, and so they were anti-Zionist, as indeed is Russia, has been Russia much of the time. Yes, I grew up in a strictly Zionist environment. My father was a very Orthodox Jew, so were my, I only remember one grandmother, but so I was told were my grandparents. But this I must state, and whenever I speak about my father or my parents, I must state this because it was very unique. As Orthodox as my father was, his main thrust, as far as his children were concerned, my parents' children were concerned, were toward education. But that meant not only Jewish education or religious education or parochial education, but total education. And the high school in my hometown was a private high school and a very expensive one, and it was difficult for Jews to get in the first place. And secondly, Orthodox Jews would not conceive of sending their children, at least not in my hometown, because one had to go to school 6 days a week, and that included the Sabbath, so of course it was out of the question. And so whenever I speak with my brother, we are still amazed at our parents' courage, I would say, or foresightedness, but also courage, to break out of the mold and to be determined to send the children to high school. My oldest brother, who is here in America, was the first one to go. And because the principal was a family friend, somehow my brother was excused from attending on the Sabbath. When my second brother's turn came to go to school, he went on the Sabbath, but without the books. When my turn came, I carried the books, but I didn't write. And it was a very long walk. There were no buses, no cars, of course, no trolleys. We walked. It was a very long walk. And I remember that on Shabbat, when I was walking from school, somewhere in the middle of the way, I'd meet my father. So I'd carry my books in one hand and my father's talit in the other hand. And we would walk home together. Upon entering home, that was the Shabbat. It was like entering a sanctuary. And from that moment on, whatever happened in school was severed. And from that moment on, it was strictly a holiday Shabbat atmosphere. It's very difficult for Americans, I think, to comprehend this. But if I told you that my father's peers, his friends, his fellow Hasidim, they looked very, very negatively at this decision of my parents, and they would say that my father is making doing something sacrilegious. They almost excommunicated him. That's no
what was his occupation?
My father was a watchmaker, and part of the time, when the times were good, we had a store, and we sold some whatever is sold in a jewelry store. During the Depression, he worked. When the Russians came in, of course, he did only manual work. I mean, he only worked as a watchmaker. And incidentally, so did I. I have a picture to prove it somewhere here. I found it in Israel this past summer when I visited my uncle. I knew there was such a picture because I remember when they snapped it. Both my brother and I, no, let me start with my oldest brother, the one who is here now. After high school, he went on to the university in Lvov. Our hometown was near the large city of Lvov, under the Austrian occupation, it was called Lemberg. And in Polish, it's Lvov. When Leon, my oldest brother, went on to the university, he supported himself through private tutoring and taking watches for repair, which some he did on his own and some he sent home for father to fix. And this is how he supported himself. I remember my parents insisted very much that he make sure that he eats at least one good meal a day. And so he was very fortunate in having one lesson, where in return for the lesson, he was given that one meal a day. Now, it would be here in America the equivalent of a dinner. There it was in the afternoon. As you may know, in Europe, the main meal is during the afternoon. So after that time, my parents were not so worried. My younger brother was not very fond of the trade. He was very, very intellectual, very, very brilliant, spoke several languages at a very young age. And but he too helped out in the store, and then came my turn, and I happened to love it very much. So I sat at the table, which was right near the front huge window, as a store has, and I worked there with my father. And someone passed by and snapped the picture. And I always thought of it, how much I'd love to have it. Well, in Israel, I found it. I promised my uncle I'd make copies and send it back. So I have it somewhere here. So my younger brother also went through high school, and then the war broke out. And then came my turn, and I graduated from gymnasium at a very young age, not because I was brilliant, but because I was enrolled at a very young age. And so at 16, I got my matura. At that time, I ought to go back to my brother first. In Lvov, he got his bachelor's and master's degree in mathematics and physics and philosophy. And it was very difficult for a Jew to get a job. And my father was not very satisfied anyway, because it would have meant working on the Shabbat. And so it seemed to have been destined for, from a very young age, that he go into theology. There had been some rabbis in the family, and this was their main objective. Unfortunately, this was already 38, and Vienna was already under the German occupation, and we already sensed that something was imminent, and Warsaw was not very safe anymore. Anyway, we had a private tutor for Hebrew. The family did. I mean, we kids did. He was also our professor in gymnasium. He taught us history and Jewish religion. In our high schools, religion was a subject. So this Dr. Löw taught my younger brother and me privately Hebrew. He was a graduate of the, I'll finish the subject, he was a graduate of the rabbinical school in Vienna. And he was also a family friend, and somehow between him and my father and mother, it was decided that Leon should apply to the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Possibly he could get in and go to America. He had, incidentally, simultaneously, while he was at the university, was attending the Hebrew Pedagogical Institute in Lvov, and he was giving Hebrew, and he was tutoring in Hebrew as well. Well, they sent the application. Leon passed an examination by proxy. He was examined by the rabbi of Lvov, who was Rabbi Kahane, who I think survived, and by some other then prominent people in the city of Lvov, of whom no one survived. And that exam and all his credentials were sent to the Jewish Theological Seminary, and he arrived here on a boat in December 8th, 1938. After he arrived, I was still at that time in high school, and I graduated, and he wrote home that yes, there is a teacher's institute at the seminary, and yes, there are girls, and yes, maybe I could come also. So I applied, and I was admitted. And the rest is history. While my birth certificate, my high school diploma, all my documents were safely tucked away at 3080 Broadway at the seminary, I remained in Europe. I was supposed to have come here in September of 39. I had my passport, I had everything, and the war broke out.
Yes, well, I must ask you about anti-Semitism in Poland. You've mentioned it already several times. Mm-hmm. And you knew what was happening in Germany from 33 on. Mm-hmm. Why didn't the Polish people make, Polish Jews make some kind of move?
Well, first of all, hindsight, I suppose, is very good. Yes, we knew more or less about what was happening in Germany, not to the extent that it was happening, and of course it was not happening yet to that extent in those years. But we had our own native anti-Semitism, and frankly, as George and I often talk,
George is your husband.
George is my husband. We were used to anti-Semitism. We learned to live with it. We knew it not only personally, and not only the current anti-Semitism, but we were familiar with Jewish history, and we knew that at one time or another, in one part of the world or another, there had been anti-Semitism, and here we still are, 2,000 years later. So maybe it will only be a passing semblance of anti-Semitism, maybe only some pain, some beating, some hatred, some deaths. We have had pogroms before. No one No one could imagine what would really happen. Yes, Hitler said it. Of course he said it in Mein Kampf. And a lot of people said it. And now we know that Martin Luther said it too. A lot of nice people said it. And so we didn't take it seriously. Secondly, it was very difficult to get out from Poland, especially. It was easier from Germany. Possibly, first of all, there was such a thing as a quota. Every country had its quota. This is in reference to coming to the United States, because I believe this is what you said. Poland had a quota, and the Polish quota had been exhausted, simply because people from Poland went to America more often than from Germany. Jews were quite comfortable in pre-Hitlerian Germany and did not fill their quota, while from Poland they were always anxious to go. So when the crisis arose, when the time came when it was urgent to come, the quota had been filled, and America, no, was not willing to do away with the quota, or to raise the quota, and there were other limits, of course. I remember when my brother was leaving, he wrote to us later, it was standard procedure, for instance, for the American consulate to test the prospective immigrants. It sufficed if one was not illiterate, if one could sign his name, and most of the immigrants of the pre-war period were this kind of people. My brother apparently was the very first person to go as a student on a student's visa to America, because prior to that time, nobody had to go to America to study. You went to Germany, to Austria, to France, to England, to anywhere, but to America. If you went to America, it was either as an immigrant or possibly before the war to the as a visitor to the exhibit, the World's Fair. But Leon apparently was the first one, and they didn't know what to do with him, what to ask him. So they called in a knowledgeable Jewish person in Warsaw and asked him to interview or to test Leon to see whether he is genuine, whether it's not fake. So anyway, this was the reason we did not consider it. We did not have any close relatives here. There was a distant relative whom my parents uncovered when it became obvious that Leon was going here, and they wrote to this so-called uncle. He was a stepbrother of my grandfather's or something like that. Our son is going to New York to the Jewish Theological Seminary. Would you be kind enough to, I don't know when they asked him to pick him up or not. Well, as it turned out, and I must tell you this, yes, when they received the letter with a picture, this uncle and aunt had two children, a son who was a little younger than Leon and a daughter who was 11 years younger than Leon. Leon was by then 25, and Ruth was 14. And this man received the letter, looked at the picture, and says, "Here comes a groom for Ruth." And lo and behold, a groom it was. And Ruth is now my sister-in-law and has been for 35 years.
Well, that's a lovely story.
Like my brother tells it, I have heard him say, he was being honored, incidentally, he is a rabbi here in America. He was being honored at some anniversary, I don't recall, 25th or 30th or 20th or whatever. He was recalling the history, how he came here, how he met Ruth, and then his studies here and so forth. And so he says, well, then at a certain point one day he said to Ruth, and he said, we used to be distant relatives. I said to Ruth, let's not be so distant anymore. So I thought that was cute.
When the war started, when the war, 1939, September 1939, how was your life affected?
Good. I would like to say something, anti-Semitism once again prior to that date. I was the only Jewish girl in my class in high school. There was a Jewish boy at one time or another for a short period of time, but I was the only Jewish girl. And I grew up among Gentiles. I grew up with Gentile friends. We were very, very close friends. To come back to my father again, yes, he permitted me to participate in all activities, even to singing in the choir, in school, and in church, and so forth. And nonetheless, local anti-Semitism, the innate anti-Semitism, plus the one that had infiltrated from the West, had its repercussions in our small hometown as well. And before my graduation, some of my so-called best friends went to the Board of Education and demanded that I not be permitted to graduate because I'm Jewish. So this is just a...
Did you graduate?
Yes, I did. This is just a little something. As for my brother's stay at the university during those years, 34 through 38, he very often got a beating, and he has pictures to prove it. He has some pictures. We were looking at them some years ago when he is all bandaged up and bloodied up. He was beaten up quite often, regularly.
Was there any overt action in your community itself?
In my community, prior to 39?
Yes.
Yes, there always was. There always was. I remember one time we were shocked because a Jew was in jail. Now, I say this now, I'm sure there are many Jews who are in jail now. I'm not so sure. I imagine there are. I hope not. But I remember when, and I'm digressing, which is my fault. When I was at Hunter College in New York, and I was taking a course in sociology, among others, our teacher was an Italian woman. And I will never forget it. She made the statement, which to me was just such a fantastically beautiful thing to have been said by a non-Jewish person. I had just arrived here, and I was not yet familiar with Gentiles who can be kind and decent and understanding and liberal. And this woman said, and at first I did not consider her liberal because she was very much of a supporter of Mussolini. And often in class she would say, even though she was an American born of Italian descent, she felt Mussolini had done great things for Italy. But that time she said, we were talking about juvenile delinquency and crime and prisons and so forth. And she said, and of course she says, there are very few Jews who have any such problems, very few Jewish inmates in the prisons, very few Jewish broken families, very few Jewish juvenile delinquency. And I remember sitting there and just being so overwhelmed at her kindness that she made such a statement. Of course, this is history because that was some 30 years ago, and by now Jews too have their share of crime and juvenile delinquency and broken families and so forth. But to come back home, I remember one time somebody came in and said there is a Jew in prison. And of course, if there's a Jew in prison, then he has to be brought kosher food because everybody ate kosher, and he has to be, brought in a prayer book or whatever. And people wanted to know, why is he in prison? And I know you won't believe it. There was a statue of Mary in this town square. It's not customary, I believe, here in the United States. There can be, I suppose, in a churchyard or when I pass by St. Francis Hospital, is it? There is a statue and so forth. Also, in front of some private homes, I've noticed. But in Poland, it was quite common, and so it was in Europe, that in the town square, there was a statue. And the accusation was that the man walked past this statue in the street and he spit at the statue. And so he was arrested, and he was and that was the case. I would like to say something about spitting. It has nothing to do with this. My brother and I often laugh, and people who travel from Europe, through Europe, I don't know how Europe is now, but in those days, we were taught hygiene, and especially TB and that sort of thing, and it spread through germs, and the germs through spitting. And every store, by law, every store was required to have, what do you call it?
Spittoon.
Right. Spittoons?
Spittoons.
Okay. And so the fact that he spit in the street, it was just a matter of habit, I suppose, and many people did. Maybe he was not well-mannered, but it was a good reason to put him into prison. And then, go ahead.
Oh, okay, you had mentioned that religion was a subject in school. Mm-hmm. Well, how did you get, I mean, did you have to take religion in school, and what kind of religion did you
yes.
take?
Yes. We took Jewish religion. There was a book by Balaban, I remember. And now the author was Balaban, who was a very famous scholarly Jew. And that was the standard text that we took. And we were studying, frankly, not religion. Now, as I think about it, it was Jewish history that we were studying.
But they let you, the Pope, that?
Yes, that text. I think primarily because there was a subject, religion, period. And most of the population of Poland is Roman Catholic. But our part of the country, there were also some Greek Catholics. We call them here the Greek Orthodox, because we had Ukrainians as well. And so I think it was like one or two periods a week, probably one, we split between the three denominations. Each one went to a separate classroom, and no, we did not study religion. There was no need to study religion. And now, as I think about it, it's interesting. I've never talked about it. I've never formulated quite this way, but now as I do, it comes back to me. No, the Balaban's text was the history of the Jews. And this is what we were learning, because religion we lived. And that was very natural. It was the way of life, and that you learned at home, and there was no need to learn that in school.
Did you go to Hebrew school?
Yes, yes. I went to the identical type of Hebrew school that that we have here, and that I was teaching in prior to where I teach now, except for one difference. The Hebrew schools were not congregationally sponsored. Even though there were various congregations and various synagogues. The school I attended was sponsored by Tarbut. The word Tarbut means culture, but it was a movement, a Zionist movement. And this is what we were studying. Many of the subjects which are being taught in the Hebrew schools now were totally unnecessary there, because, as I mentioned before, they were learned at home. It was primarily the Hebrew language, the history of Zionism, a subject called Palestinography, which means the geography of Palestine.
I just have to stop this. This is so sad.
I attended that school. Would you like to check first?
No, it's all right. No.
I attended that school three times a week. But I received a lot of additional learning even before Dr. Loew came to town from my father. It was standard that every Saturday afternoon, after we ate, each one of us children would sit down with father and study. And later on, I had private tutors, and the last few years, when Dr. Loew was in town, he taught me. And that was my Hebrew education. Of course, when I came to this country, I entered the seminary, and so I continued there.
Did you have a food called Choland?
Choland.
Yeah, my grandmother mentioned.
Yes, my grandmother made Choland. Because my grandmother was extremely Orthodox, what we call here glut or frumi or whatever. My parents were glut kosher too. I mean, as far as kashrut, there was absolutely no digression and no compromise in any shape or form on the part of a religious Jew. Unless one was irreligious or assimilated or whatever, but otherwise it was strictly kosher. However, there were certain things in which my parents were not that adherent. In other words, yes, the stove was being heated on Shabbat and food was being heated. So I don't remember Cholent in my home. Another thing, first, there were so many firsts with my family that I now remember. For instance, baking at home was a great chore. There was the oven that you had to put in wood and so forth. My father was a very, very doting husband and father. He always felt it was too hard for my mother to do it. As a result, she was the only one, it seemed, at least at that time, who would buy challah for Shabbat, because he wouldn't let her bake. But of course, when she baked other goodies and so forth. Yes, I do want to say this too about their having the courage to send the children to gymnasium. It seemed at a very young age, and we later found out in Leon's records in high school, a church prelate, who was a very close friend of my father's, Ksiądz Kulakowski, we called him in Polish, meaning prelate Kulakowski, he wrote somewhere in my brother's records, future rabbi. At that time he may have been 10, 12, 14, I don't remember the age. And so he was destined to be the future rabbi.
Tell us what happened in 1939.
Okay. Well, prior to what happened, I was spending a very exciting summer because I was getting ready to come to America. I was shopping for clothes with whatever means we had. I was studying very hard, both Hebrew and a little bit of English. I didn't know much by the time I arrived here. And looking forward to coming here. And then September 1st, we woke up to the sound of bombs. Oh, we didn't know there were bombs. We thought it was just, we didn't know what it was. We really couldn't believe. We were really caught by surprise. And I remember when we looked out the window, across from us was the courthouse. And the courthouse stood on a hill. And I will never forget it. I remember the first thing I saw was the janitor from the courthouse standing on the hill with a rifle shooting at an airplane. And I remember the people laughing so hard that he was going to shoot at the airplane with a rifle. Later on, when I had a lot of time to think about it and contemplate it, it became to me a symbol of the quick disintegration of Poland and the quick surrender. In other words, the naivete of the Polish defenders. Here is a man he was a man, an adult, thinking that he can shoot a rifle at an airplane. Apparently it was symptomatic of the entire defense system of Poland, because it just went 1, 2, 3, you know. And for a short while, for a few days, and then the Germans, we heard the Germans were coming in, and they were not far from us. we went into a village for a while the bombs were still coming down. And during the period before the Germans came in, the local population held the reins, and this was one thing the older generation was very concerned about and frightened of. We didn't know what it was all about, but they remembered World War II. And they always...
World War One.
And they always said that it's worse not to have any rule, any government, than to have the total anarchy that holds the reins during a changeover or before an occupational force takes over. And shortly after that, the Germans came in. I remember when the first German came in, he came into the store. My father first of all, no, we did not anticipate what was coming at all. No, we thought that we did believe that the leftist people, both Jewish and non-Jewish, may be persecuted, that Jews as Jews will be persecuted in general, that there may be limits, that there may be even a ghetto, that there may be even concentration camps where people will go to work and come back home, which was the case indeed in the beginning in Germany. But these were things that a Jew was ready to accept. He had no alternative. And as I said, we had grown up with anti-Semitism and persecution, and what else is new?
Had you personally been through any pogroms before that?
No. So what happened, I remember when the first German came in, my father spoke a very good German, as did mother, as did my brother. My second brother was a hunchback. And he became ill when he was like 3 years old, and they sent him to Vienna, and he was there for 4 years. He spoke a beautiful German. And he thought that, considering that he can converse with them so beautifully, surely they will take this into consideration. I mean, you know, the normal flow of thought of a person is, I have something in common with this other person. Another thing also is this. Strange as it may sound, my parents were, not only my parents, the Jews were great Austrian patriots. Franz Joseph was very good to the people, and during the First World War they were in Austria and they were in Vienna. And I remember father always talking about how he admired the cleanliness, the honesty, the integrity, and primarily the fact that those customers never had to never bargained. It was easy to do business with them, while the peasants in our hometown were so hard to deal with. So they always wanted to bargain. And father said, to live in a society when you can just tell a customer a price, and this is the price, and this is it, it was just ideal. So they came in, and when my father stood up and greeted them and said hello or whatever, the first thing was they slapped him on both sides. They hit him over the head, threw him to the floor. When my brother came forward, it was the same thing. And that was our introduction to the Germans. The Germans were in my hometown for about 2 weeks when we heard that when we heard about the deal made by between Ribbentrop and Molotov, and that Russia and Germany were splitting Poland in half, and that we were going to be under the Russian occupation. And so the Russians entered. Now, I don't know if you want me to talk about that period.
Yes. Yeah.
You do. The Russians entered, and at first, not much seemed to change. My father was working, and not having been a wealthy man, not having been a capitalist, it seemed on the surface that we had nothing to fear. And I even made plans to go to Lvov and enroll at the university. Which I did. I went there and I went to school, and things seemed to be so-so. However, my parents told me that they heard some rumors that the Russians were suspicious of them, and they couldn't for the life of them understand why. And then one day, I was home, and my mother was home. I was home in Turka, in my hometown, and they came in and took my brother. My brother and I were in the back. There was an apartment in the back of the store. Were in the back. My brother and father were in the store. They took my father and they took my brother, and as my mother and I ran out the back door and looked across the town square to the other side where the police